I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. In a career spanning more than 30 years, Irish novelist John Boyne has published 18 novels for adults, 6 novels for younger readers, a short story collection, and a picture book. He's best known for The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, which was a New York Times #1 bestseller and adapted for film, theater, opera, and ballet, selling more than 11 million copies worldwide. Among his many international bestsellers are The Heart's Invisible Furies, A Ladder to the Sky, and All the Broken Places. We spoke with Boyne about his novel, The Elements, a collection of 4 stories that examine sexual abuse from 4 perspectives: the enabler, the accomplice, the perpetrator, and the victim. Each of the 4 elements, water, earth, fire, and air, was released in serial form in the UK. Now published together, they make up a collection that encourages readers to reconsider how they think about sexual abuse. Here's our conversation. So The Elements is a novel made up of 4 parts, connected by the 4 elements, but also recurring characters. Can you give our listeners a description of the novel?
Yes. As you say, it's 4 parts: water, earth, fire, and air. And each of them are standalone stories, but they are completely connected. So a minor character from each becomes the narrator of the next one. And we kind of work around in a circle. So characters from each kind of bounce in and out. But the overriding theme of the book is about sexual abuse. But I'm looking at it in 4 different perspectives. So from an enabler, from complicity, from perpetrator, and from victim. So together they make up one novel.
And did one story come first? I mean, how did you decide who was going to tell the next story? Did you write them in the order that they appear in The Elements?
I did. In the UK, they were published first. They were actually published individually every 6 months over the last 2 years. So they were just like short novellas. But then we put them together into one book, as well as in the way that they're doing in the States. And so I started with water, and I started with this idea of a woman who has, she's leaving a very long-term marriage and is traveling across Ireland to a small island off the west coast of Ireland, where she has to confront the fact that we learn very early on that her husband has been imprisoned for crimes against children. And she has to ask herself, has she enabled that over the years? She doesn't know the answer to that question. She's spending a year there to figure it out. So as I was writing that short book, the idea for the foursome came to me. And that's when I thought about the minor character idea. So what I did was really just let the story build in the way that it would naturally, organically. And then when I would get to the end of the first draft, I'd have chosen somebody who I thought, right, well, they're going to be the person I'm going to focus on in the next book. So I might give them like just a little extra scene or two, but not very much. I just wanted them to be very, very minor, but that if you read all 4 books together, there would always be these little connections between them.
Let's talk about the elements. And here I mean water, earth, fire, and air. You know, separately, they hold great importance for the principal character in each section. In water, Willow reflects, the elements are our greatest friends, our animators. They feed us, warm us, give us life, and yet conspire to kill us at every juncture. And later, one of the characters comments on how the elements destroy everything. Can you talk about the elements and the power they hold?
Yes. Well, these are the 4 traditional building blocks of the universe. But, you know, as you mentioned in that excerpt, that we need all of these to survive, but they can also kill us. You know, we need water, but we can drown. You know, so they are as important to us as they are fatal. And I wanted to kind of think about that idea. So I used those themes for each of the characters. So with water, for example, with Willow, she's on an island. She's surrounded by water. Her husband was a swimming coach. In Earth, Evan is he's a footballer, but he's grown up on a farm. You know, he's very much grown up with his hands in the soil. I even used the letters. So it's water, Willow, Earth, Evan, fire, Freya, air, Aaron. Sometimes I say that when I'm doing festival events and people go, oh, God, didn't see that. You know, it's like a little small thing. But I think readers coming to the whole 4 books will probably see in each one the way I use each theme to describe the characters, to find some sort of depth to each character that I'm writing about.
So you mentioned that you were writing from 4 perspectives of crime: the enabler, the accomplice, the perpetrator, and the victim. But I also wonder about writing from a specific gender perspective. Can you talk about writing the female voice? Because two of the four stories are told from a woman's perspective. Was that a challenge?
Well, I knew starting out that I wanted to write basically two boys, two girls, adults, you know, two men, two women. And I wanted to mix it up in that way. It's actually not as challenging to do that as people sometimes think. I've written two novels before, in fact, This House is Haunted and All the Broken Places, which were both narrated by women. And, you know, I've written a lot of novels which are historically based. And so I don't think it's any different sort of pretending to be a, say, a soldier from the First World War or a, a Russian bodyguard in the Tsar's days than it is to, you know, imagine what it is to be a woman. So I think every novelist has to use their imagination every time. So I don't find it that difficult. And I think actually more men should write stronger female characters and write occasionally from the perspective of a woman. It gives you a different insight into the story.
This book challenges the reader to consider what they expect from men and women in terms of who is the perpetrator of violence and who is the victim. Sometimes this is explicit through dialogue and sometimes it's implied. For example, late in the book, a minor character, Charlotte, comments that she thinks a daughter would have been easier to raise than a son, but then adds that girls are so much more vulnerable than boys. Can you talk a little bit about this, you know, challenging these gender roles?
Yes, I think the biggest way I've challenged them is in the third section, Fire, where the perpetrator isn't a man, it's a woman. And she's somebody who's abusing young boys. And we read a lot, of course, I mean, the majority of sexual crimes are committed, of course, by men, but not all. And I have found in recent years that we seem to read a lot about, it's often teachers, female teachers who are abusing their male students or raping their male students, because actually once it's a minor, it's rape, you know, there's no other word for it. And one thing that's always bothered me is that when you see those stories, you'll often get men say, oh, I wish that had happened to me in school. I wish my female teacher had done that. But they'd probably be the same people who would be out with the pitchforks if their daughter was abused at school, and, you know, rightly so. And there is, I wanted to get across the idea that there is no difference, really, that the effect that sexual abuse can have on a girl is exactly the same as it can have on a boy. Perhaps with a boy, it might take longer for them to realize that effect, but it will be there. You know, nobody should be abused at a young age. It doesn't matter whether you're a boy or a girl. So I wanted to challenge that a little bit and to just recognize the fact that it happens to boys too.
There were moments in the book when someone had been exposed as doing something horrible, and amid the uproar, a supporter would emerge, issue an apology for offending anyone by showing support, but not really apologize because they had meant what they said. And then another scandal would emerge, taking the focus and the public ire with it. It felt like these defenders were men defending men. Are we more forgiving of men than of women in society?
I think we probably are. I think we're just accustomed to doing it. And yeah, there are scenes where, there's one particular scene I remember where a man is explaining to Willow in the first section about what led him to prison, which was a drink driving crash. And he tells his story in quite an emotional way. And in writing it, even though I'm the one writing it, I felt what he's doing is he's waiting for her to kind of reach across and say, it's okay, you know, you served your sentence and you're forgiven by society and all this. And he justifies what he has done by saying, you know, the thing about me is, and he's like 50-odd, the thing about me is, you know, I'm still a teenager at heart. You know, I always feel like that. And what it takes is for her to say to him, but you're not. You're not. You're a grown man. You're a middle-aged man. And you don't get to just sort of pass it off like that and say, oh, you know, I still feel like I did when I was a kid. Because we're supposed to grow older. We're supposed to take responsibility for our actions. We're not supposed to act as adults in the impulsive way that we do when we're teenagers, when our prefrontal cortexes haven't fully formed yet. So, you know, I did want to challenge that a little bit inside it, because we are so much less forgiving of women in society. You know, there's always this thing about like being a bad mother, for example, not so much about being a bad father. Even in some of like the, you know, there's a rape case in this book. And even today, you know, rape victims can be asked in court questions about the clothing they wear, as if something about clothing allows a rape to happen or justifies it in some way. And of course, it doesn't. So all of those little things, I do write a lot about gender in books and about the way that men tend to get away with things a lot more than women do. And I feel quite strong about that.
This book is so serious in nature, but peppered throughout are some laugh out loud moments. You know, how do you like your tea? As God intended, milk and three sugars. You know, there wasn't a lot of humor, but I'm wondering how you determine the correct balance in a book that is as serious as this.
I think a lot of it comes through in the rewriting. You just know instinctively where you need to lighten the mood for a moment. It's interesting you ask me this because anytime I talk to creative writing students in universities or anything, I always say to them, no matter how dark your book is, no matter what you're writing about, try and throw in a few jokes. Honestly, it's good for the reader, but it's actually really good for the book as well. That, you know, you can build the tension, then you can sort of let the reader sort of breathe for a moment and then build it back. I mean, even in my most famous book, The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, which is, you know, obviously a very difficult and traumatic subject matter, there are jokes in there through the kids' misunderstandings. So I think it's always really important to find moments for that. And as a writer, I think you just learn to trust your instinct on it and your gut about where is the right moment to just, you know, break this tension a little bit.
Did I see a recurring reference to David Bowie?
Yes, you did. And there's, yeah, a few little things like that in the book where each story has a reference. And I chose David Bowie simply because I was listening to a lot of David Bowie at the time. And I just found a way to kind of put him into each scene, either with somebody listening on the radio or putting a record on. And I tried to find lots of little links, you know, between the four. And it was quite difficult because, as I mentioned with the UK editions, the first two, for example, were out. The first one was out while I was writing the third. The second one was out while I was writing the fourth. So there's no way of going back to change anything. And I was thinking back to things like, you know, those sort of when Dickens was serializing in the 19th century, and you wrote the piece, published it in the newspaper, and that's it. You're stuck with the story that you have. So I wanted to find these little moments. So yeah, there's a few little connections, and the Bowie one is one.
So this was a true serial.
I guess it really was. Yeah. Because I mean, every 6 months here, so it was a 2-year project for me, and I'd never done that sort of thing before. It was a nice challenge.
Speaking of humor, and maybe this isn't funny, how do you pronounce the Welsh name of the town that means St. Mary's Church in the Hollow of the White Hazel near the Rapid Whirlpool and the Church of St. Tessio of the Red Cave? It's
You've
that
lost me
long
there.
LLAN.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's Welsh. I'm Irish, so it's like Clondidachlunda or something. I don't know.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
I hope that it'll prove a little bit provocative. That, you know, questions are asked that aren't always asked, and about these crimes, and that we will look at these individuals in a different way. I feel very strongly that, and I suppose it's not an original thought, but the more that we understand why people commit these acts, the more we could get to a place where there will be less of them. That, of course, we would all say, you know, that anybody who commits a sexual crime against a child, it's heinous, they should be imprisoned. But once they are, I feel the more that we can find out, well, what is their story? What is their past? What led them to this moment? Obviously, not everybody who is abused goes on to abuse, but most of those who abuse have been abused. And that's something I think we need to, and that's not to justify anything, but to understand more about the past and then help victims today in a more educated way could potentially lessen these things happening in the future. So I guess I'm trying to find ways just to look at this story in a fresh way, and maybe readers will find it, you know, thought-provoking.
Well, the book is The Elements. John Boyne, thank you so much for joining us again.
You're very welcome.
The Elements by John Boyne was published by Henry Holt and Company. Joining us now is Lynn Graham. Lynn is the marketing and events coordinator at Watermark Books and Cafe right here in Wichita. Thanks for joining us, Lynn.
Thanks, Beth. Glad to be here.
Well, once again, we're having you back to talk about books that you're excited about. These can be books that are new, books that are forthcoming, or books that you just can't stop thinking about. And I see you have a large stack today.
And I am so excited to talk about all of these books. It kind of spans the gamut. I don't have any weird ones like last time, but I have some good ones.
Okay.
The one I want to start off with is Yesteryear by Caro Claire Burke. This is one of those books. You know how when a book is really anticipated, publishers pushing it. It's on all the lists of books to look forward to. And so you get a little worried if it's actually going to be that good. That was me going into this book, and it blew me away. It's stunning. I cannot believe it's a debut. It's so wonderfully crafted. This is a book about a tradwife social media influencer who, you know, looks like she has the perfect life on her farm with all of her children, and she bakes all her food from scratch and makes their clothes and just seemingly has this picture perfect life. But of course, behind the scenes, she has all this help. She and her husband, you know, their marriage isn't as perfect as they would want it to seem. She's got a teenage daughter that's becoming very disillusioned with her life. So there's all of these factors holding this tension. And then one day this woman wakes up and she has been transported back to the early 1800s.
Oh, my word.
And has to actually live the life she's been claiming to live. It's such an incredibly razor-sharp exploration of kind of that tradwife influencing fundamentalist Christianity. We're seeing a lot of this in our culture today, and there's like this weird push and pull between it. And this book explores it in such a great way that I was hooked from page one to the end. I never could figure out what was happening, because the whole time you're like, is this a magical realism situation? Did she actually get sent back in time somehow? What is going on? And I did not figure it out until the last page. And the ending was so perfect. Again, as a debut, you're just stunned that she could craft such an amazing book and really get to the heart of some of these issues in the conversations we're seeing right now about these influencers and trying to look so perfect, and what is femininity and what is like womanhood and what are women supposed to do, whether or not you're in a fundamentalist religion or not. And this book just wrapped it up in a way that I thought was absolutely perfect. The epilogue especially gets right to the heart of it, and I cannot recommend this book highly enough. Like I said, it's one of those where if you're like, oh, it seems really highly, you know, it's one of those big books, I don't think I'm interested. You are interested. I don't think anyone could read this book and not find something incredibly intriguing about it. So that is Yesteryear by Carol Claire Burke. The next book I want to talk about is Canon by Paige Lewis. And Paige is a poet, first and foremost. This is their debut novel. This is for readers of Kaveh Akbar and Karen Russell and Lauren Groff. And this was a fantastic book that kind of came out of left field for me. I wasn't expecting it. I didn't know what it was going to be. We had another bookseller at the store meet them at a conference, had already read the book and loved it and convinced the rest of us to read it. And we were like, yeah, we'll pick it up. It seems fun. It is your typical hero quest, but in the most fantastical, bizarre, absurd, fun way. So it's like nothing you've ever read before. This is a book about a person who God comes to and tells them they need to kill the general of the army that's on the other side of the war they're fighting. And they're just a person. They don't have any experience with this. They don't know why God wants them to do this. And so they tell God no. Mm. And then God blackmails them. And so they have to go on this quest to learn how to become the person who could do this. There's a talking whale, which is incredible. And then on the other side, we have this prophet. So this is a prophet who God has been in her head ever since her mother, the previous prophet, died. And this woman thinks she should be the one to get the glory and kill the general and save the world, basically. So you have these two opposing beliefs of I should be the hero and I don't want to be the hero and who God wants where. I'm making it sound more serious than it is. It's very much not serious. While there are serious themes and you definitely come away very reflective, it's very, very fun. And this is why I mentioned that Paige is a poet first and foremost, because they originally wanted this to be an epic poem and realized the scope is too big, can't be an epic poem, but it still reads like a poem. It almost is broken up into stanzas. It's every chapter is a page and a half, very short, very snappy. their writing is so lyrical, so beautiful. It is captivating. It is a 400-something page book, and I flew through it like it's under 300 pages because it just reads so quickly and you want to know what's going on. And it is sharp. It is satirical. It is witty. It is unlike anything I've ever read, which is something I am always looking for and going to be very, very excited about. And I just think this is for everyone. This is, again, for if you like literary fiction, it's for you. If you're a fantasy reader, it's for you. If you like speculative, it's for you. I really think everyone can find something in this book to read and get excited about. That is Canon by Paige Lewis.
Okay.
All right, the next book. This one came out in January of 2026. It's kind of making the rounds. It is Lost Lambs by Madeline Cash. This is, again, another debut. I am loving the debuts right now because we're getting a lot of new, younger authors with a lot to say and kind of a fresh take on their genres. And what this one is a dysfunctional family story, which we've all read before. But this is done in a way that kind of turns every expectation on its head, where you go, yeah, yeah, I know what's going to happen. Oh, the parents have decided to have this open marriage. They're going to reconcile. Oh, the daughters, you know, obviously are struggling with this new dynamic in their family. They're all struggling in their own ways. Everything's going to come together in the end. And while it does end very hopefully, again, it subverts every expectation that you have, and everything is so silly. It's not a book that I think is meant to be taken seriously, like a lot of dysfunctional family novels. I think this is poking fun at a lot of those books where it is so ridiculous, because again, it is ridiculous. The parents are in this reluctantly, one of them is reluctantly entered into this open marriage concept. There are three daughters, one of whom is a senior in high school and is dating an older man named War Crimes Wes. There's the middle daughter who is in this online relationship with who she thinks is another teenager and is actually a terrorist who is trying to get her to build a bomb. There's the youngest daughter who's a pathological liar but is trying to convince everyone that something is wrong and they are being surveilled in their town by the billionaire that owns all the property. And so you hear this and go, are you sure this isn't a serious dysfunctional? No. It's so fun. It's so absurd. It's so silly. And you end up loving all these characters by the end because you get to see inside of all their heads, see why they're struggling, but you do get to see them grow over the course of the book into a person who takes their situation, takes what's happening to them, and finds a way to grow and move on in a mostly healthy way. And like I said, it ends up hopeful in a way that you aren't expecting until near the end. And it's just a fun book that I think is something we're all looking for right now. And that is Lost Lambs by Madeline Cash. A book I cannot stop thinking about that came out of left field for me is Eradication by Jonathan Miles. This is a teeny tiny little book. And by that, I mean in many ways. The physical book is beautiful and just this great size to hold in your hands. The book itself is very short. And the full title is actually Eradication : A Fable. And I think that is so important when you are reading this book because it is. It is truly just this weird little fable. And we are following a man who is very downtrodden. He has lost everything important to him in his life. His wife has left. His son has died. He has lost his career. He is adrift and doesn't know what to do and needs some kind of purpose. And he answers this job listing that says, you could save the world. Obviously, that's what he needs right now to build himself back up. And then he finds out that the job is to go live on this little remote island for several weeks and eradicate the invasive goats that are on the island that are eating all the local flora. And so all the fauna is dying. All the species are becoming extinct or at risk of extinction. And so the government, the elusive government, has decided the goats need to go. And he is gung-ho at first because, again, he needs this purpose until he gets to the island. He is alone. He is the only person on this island, him and the hundreds of goats that live on this island, and he has to literally come face to face with another living creature and reckon with himself. Is this saving the world? Why are the goats here? How did the goats get here in the first place? So is it our responsibility to take care of them? Is it the best thing to eradicate them? So it's just this little insular novel of this man trying to reckon with his grief, with his feeling of having no purpose, and coming together in a little bit of an explosive ending that I thought was so ridiculous but perfect to wrap it up. And I just can't see anyone coming away from this and not continuing to think about it. I read this maybe 2 months ago and have thought about it every day. That is Eradication by Jonathan Miles. All right, so my next book is Cleaner by Jess Shannon. This is what I would call in the genre of unsound women, which I love. It's a little plotless. It's a very vibey. It's a book where do you just want to be in the head of a woman who is both incredibly self-aware and not at all self-aware. That's what this book is. I enjoyed it so much more than I thought I would. It's just about this woman just out of university, sort of drifting through life, doesn't really have a goal, can't really seem to hold down a job. She knows she wants to be an artist. She went to school, she got her master's in art, but can't find anything. Ends up moving back home with her parents. They're like, you need to help around the house because you're an adult. And her mom just says to her, well, why don't you do the dishes? You know, if you want to help, do the dishes. So in this woman's probably unreliable narrative of her life, sounds like the first time she's done any kind of household work. And something clicks in her brain where it just fixes everything inside of her and she wants to clean everything. Cleaning things, organizing things really scratches an itch for her. And so she decides to become a cleaner. That's where she's going to go with her life. And that, of course, leads her on this path of meeting some other people. And maybe she goes down a path that she wasn't planning. She ends up living with a man she's known for 2 days because she became friends with his girlfriend. And then the girlfriend leaves, but she's very obsessed with the girlfriend more so than the man she's now living with. And this woman was also an artist. So she's almost trying to inhabit this woman's life. But it's so fever dreamy. You keep asking yourself, wait, what did she really just do that? Did she really just move in with this man? Did she really just wear this woman's clothes? Did she really just make these decisions? And she does. And the whole time you're like, I guess, yeah, get it, girl. I don't know. You're just on her side for no good reason. But I just had a great time. And I think it's one of those, again, when you're just kind of in the mood for an easy, plotless book, but with a really strong voice. That's what I loved about it. The voice and the personality is very distinct. And that's why I think you root for her. Because like I said, that's what's so funny is she is so self-aware while also being very unself-aware. And that's just youth, you know? So I think it does kind of bring you back to those early days of, I don't know what I'm doing. I'll just drift from job to job and I'll, you know, bed hop around until I can get a place of my own. And it does feel very genuine in a lot of ways, while obviously embellished a little bit for the novel, but just feels very honest, I think. And that's what I enjoyed about it. Just you could tell the author was really tapping into the feeling that you have in your early 20s when you don't know what you're doing and you don't really want the things you wanted aren't working out. But you don't want to get the boring job. You just don't want to get the boring job. So you're just going to drift around and figure it out for a while. And we all know that feeling. And I think that's what makes this book work. So that is Cleaner by Jess Shannon.
Well, Lynn, you have given us once again so many books to think about. This conversation has been edited for time. You can listen to the entire conversation at kmuw.org. Lynn Graham, Marketing and Events Coordinator at Watermark Books and Cafe in Wichita. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.